How ought we think about marriage and divorce? For one, marriage was created by God Himself. That right there should put a high premium on marriage. Genesis 1:27, we were created as gendered beings, male and female. Genesis 2:24, it says that the man shall leave his father, singular, and his mother, singular, to be joined to his wife, singular. And it's to these passages that both Jesus and Paul reflect when they speak to the subject of marriage, divorce, prostitution, fornication. They cite Genesis 2:24 and Genesis 1:27 respectively, because they believed that that creation of God was still in effect. We see throughout the Old Testament in Proverbs 2 and again in Malachi chapter 2 that marriage is a covenant that isn't just made with your partner, but is also made before God Himself. And so, we see that marriage was created by God and is good. 1 Timothy 4:4. And the author of Hebrews can say in Hebrews 13:4, marriage is to be held in honor among all. To be held in honor. Timios is that Greek word there. This is the word that is used for the blood of Jesus. Honor. Costly. Precious. Valuable. Divorce is only given three explicit permissible grounds in the New Testament. So we see that it is permissible. Now again, I'm using that language very carefully. Not commanded, but permitted in the case of adultery, abandonment, and death. Adultery, abandonment, and death. These are the three and only three explicit grounds for a divorce. Now, any other exceptions would need to be on par with these three. So, we're not getting along anymore. Is that tantamount to adultery? No. We're just not compatible. Is that tantamount to abandonment? No. We're having a lot of fights these days, and it's been very tense. Is that tantamount to death? No. Anything needs to be on par, at least in that ballpark. We're not seeing exhaustive lists here. Jesus gives an exception, Paul gives an exception, and he gives another exception in other places in the New Testament. So we are open to, in principle, the idea that there could be other reasons for divorce than just these three. More on that later. However, these need to be, as I said, equal to or more severe than the ones that are explicitly permitted in Scripture. A case study. Paul says that the wife married to the unbeliever should not divorce the unbeliver. Likewise, the husband married to the wife who is an unbeliever ought not to divorce him. This is from Paul. You know Paul, who in 2 Corinthians chapter 6 says, "What harmony has Christ with Belial, or the temple of God with the temple of idols? Do not be yoked with unbelievers." How much more extreme language could you get there than Paul saying that? Paul is saying, don't marry an unbeliever, and he uses the most vivid language to describe how inconsistent that is. And yet, once they're married, he says, you ought not divorce. So for someone to say, well, we're just not compatible, he's saying compatibility is out the window. That is not a grounds for divorce. And so we see here, it needs to be somewhere in that ballpark that we've described here. This view, by the way, for what it's worth, this is held by the majority of theologians and ethicists in the evangelical world today. Those who are Bible-believing, gospel-believing people, this is the view that they hold, that the exceptions would be adultery, abandonment, death, or something tantamount to that. That's the realm that we're in. That's how serious marriage is. So far, so good. This is where it's difficult. What if we're not quite to one of those extremes? And here I'm going to appeal to a philosophical paradox. And right there, I know I'm losing some of you there. You're like, here we go. All right, here we go. Tune out for 2 minutes. Please stick with me here, please. This will be so helpful in you understanding what we're dealing with and what you are dealing with as leaders. This is called the paradox of the heap. You know, para means alongside, and dox, dokeo, means to seem. So two things seem disparate, different, alongside each other, but they're not. And this is the paradox. So what constitutes a heap? A heap. You might say this, that right there, sand, 50,000 grains of sand. That's a heap. Sure, sure, sure. Sure, that's a heap of sand. However, is a single grain of sand a heap of sand? Come on, no, that's not a heap of sand. All right, what about two grains of sand? Is that a heap? No, that's not a heap. What about five grains of sand? Would that be a heap? No, somebody said no. They're like, get to the point. All right, so here's the paradox. At what point do you have successive addition of numbers to the point where you get to a heap of sand? Working in reverse. What if you have 50,000 grains of sand? Oh, that's a heap. Well, what if you take away one and you have 49,999? Still a heap? Yes. What if you take away two? What if you take away three? What if you take away four? Still a heap. But at some point, it crosses over from a bunch of grains of sand into a heap. You see where I'm going with this? On the one extreme, we have heaps. We have adultery, abandonment, death, physical abuse, child abuse, emotional abuse, and substance abuse. Sometimes these are as clear as day. If someone goes out on their spouse and commits adultery, that's clear grounds that is permissible for divorce. Reconciliation and forgiveness, again, is still in view, is still on the table. If someone abandons their spouse, that is clear grounds for divorce. Death, that would be clear grounds for divorce, or remarriage, rather. Physical abuse, what if someone's getting beaten up? That would be grounds for divorce. Child abuse, we're seeing the extremes here. Emotional abuse, I took an 8-hour class studying emotional abuse, which can be discerned, and which is volatile to people and to marriages, the level of control and the sadistic, egregious sin that is, to be emotionally abused. What I don't mean, though, is this. On the other extreme would be the grains of sand. Adultery is clear, but is flirting. How many times does one need to flirt before you have grounds for divorce? Well, what if it was flirting 25 times? No. 28 times? No. 35 times? Yep. 34 times? Maybe. See my point? At what point does it cross over from flirting, which is wrong, which is a sin, but is it grounds for divorce? You with me? At what point is it considered abandonment? Now, these are things which are explicitly taught in the New Testament. What if the husband, I'm just going to say the husband from here on out, okay? I know it could be the wife or the husband, but I'm a man, so I'm going to say the husband. He's going to be the bad guy here tonight. What if the husband leaves for the weekend and doesn't tell the wife where he's going? Is that considered abandonment and grounds for divorce? You say no. What if it was a 3-day weekend? What if it was a week? What if it was 2 weeks? What if it was a year? Okay, that's grounds for divorce. 364 days. 363. You see my point? What if it's Alzheimer's disease? It's not death. And incidentally, Pat Robertson said that we could have grounds for divorce for Alzheimer's disease. Shame on him. What about if it's physical abuse? Well, what if I just grabbed the wrist of a person? Didn't leave a mark, didn't leave a bruise. Do you see the tension we're in here? What if it isn't systematic emotional abuse? But what if it's just angry cussing at your spouse? At what point does it become grounds for divorce? You see how the paradox helps us here? Okay, this is why we are moving into this tool. And this is a tool. This isn't a one-size-fits-all solution. This is a tool to help people in that middle range, which, to be honest with you, is 95% of the issues that we deal with. In the real extreme black and white cases that are heaps, that becomes very clear. On the other hand, most issues are somewhere in between, and legal separation, as Ryan said, does a number of things. Protect spouses and children just as much as divorce would. If you're in fear for yourself or for your kids, legal separation would protect you just as well as a divorce. Yes, it would. This leaves open reconciliation. 1 Corinthians 7, verse 11, the family, the husband and wife should be reconciled with each other. And so that's a biblical virtue. Legal separation leaves open that door. It may help to reveal who is seeking an unrighteous divorce. Rhino talked about this, and help clear one's conscience. There's many benefits to this tool. Again, it's a tool. For each one of these, you could say, well, there could be some differences where somebody could try and slide through, or maybe it wouldn't quite reveal in 100% of cases. Look, we live in the real world, and we're trying to give you tools to help people. Now, that being said, there's high costs to doing something like this. The first is that this is heavy medicine. We're not encouraging people to get legal separations. Neither are we discouraging it if they feel in their conscience this is something that they need to do. But this would be the nuclear option. If you've been through the books, if you've spoken out, if you've gotten the counseling, if you've gotten the help, if you've gotten members of the Christian community to play a part and to play a role, and it still isn't doing anything, this is getting the attention of your spouse in a visceral way and saying, you need to move out and go sleep on the couch someplace else for a while. We're going to split the finances. We're going to share the kids until we can reach a state wherein we can come back together for reconciliation. As we pointed out, this is financially very expensive, just as expensive as divorce. This is why attorneys don't often like to do this. Because they say, from a worldly perspective, if you're going to be separated, why not just get divorced and be done with it? From a Christian perspective, we're saying, hold out hope to keeping your family together. However, divorce is also expensive. Let's not forget about that. Often including hidden costs, more than the financial. Let me put this simply. In divorce, everyone is a victim. In divorce, everyone is a victim. And if you're here and you've experienced divorce, if you've been through a divorce, if you're a child of divorce, if you have loved ones that have been through this, you know precisely what I'm talking about. As Jesus said, God has joined them together. Let man not separate. He says that marriage is like being woven together in your soul. And to be divorced is like to have yourself ripped in two. That's the imagery from Jesus Christ. Everyone involved here is a victim. For one, the divorce rate in America, somewhere between 41 and 50%, we're not sure. Incidentally, those who go to church once a week, so not necessarily high commitment there, but just participating in a church, 38%. Nominal Christians, those who are just Christian in name only, actually have a higher divorce rate than non-Christian people. I'll put that on your mind. First marriage, 50%, 41%, but look at this. Second and third marriages, the chances of success only decrease. The chances of failure increase. So getting a divorce, going into this is going to result in an uphill battle. That is to be sure. Linda Waite, she's the professor of sociology at the University of Chicago. She studied the National Survey of Families and Households. This was in the public domain. This is data that wasn't collected from her. It was collected by this research group. And she found this. She says, quote, on most measures, ways that you could quantify, divorce was never associated with an increase in the emotional well-being of unhappily married spouses. Let that sink in for a second. I'm going to get the divorce and get out, and then I'm going to be happy. No, you're going to be you. I'm going to be me. We're still going to be in the same situation. Now, to be clear, I want to be crystal clear on this. This isn't in the case of domestic violence, cases like that. Yes, we would encourage protection for the abused. Of course we would do that. And yet, at the same time, she's saying getting a divorce is not the solution to your problems. Divorce did not make unhappy spouses happier, reduce depression, or increase self-esteem. This was after controlling for all these different selective effects, race, income, education, age, gender, didn't matter, didn't help. What about unhappy spouses who remain married over this five-year period? Unhappy spouses. Well, these would be the people that you would say, well, of course, if they were unhappy over this five-year period, they would be unhappy later. Not true. Two-thirds who avoided divorce were happily married 5 years later. Just sticking it out for the 5 years, you discover at the tail end that you've been through the grief. You've been through these different seasons of life. You've been through the kids and all of the craziness that brings with it. And as you fight through that as a couple, what do you discover? That suffering forged you together in fire. And now we're actually closer than we used to be. Okay, but she ups the ante. What about very unhappy spouses? So what about these? Of course, these would be the ones not as good. Not true. 8 out of 10 who avoided divorce were happily married 5 years later. Of course, this is sans abuse, not including abuse, stuff like that. These are people that are having intractable differences and yet sticking it through for 5 years. They found out that actually working through it brought about deep, deep satisfaction in the marriage. Paul Amato. Now, there's experts, and then there's experts, and then there's Paul Amato when it comes to divorce. He's what they call in scholarship a pace setter. He's the kind of person that other people quote. He's the kind of person that other people look at what he's doing. What's Paul Amato saying on this subject? He's a professor of sociology at Penn State University. He writes this, that children of divorce, not just spouses and how it affects us, but children of divorce exhibit more conduct problems, more emotional problems, lower academic test scores and school grades, more problems with social relationships, weaker emotional ties with parents, especially fathers, obtain less education, earn less income, have a greater risk of depression, have poor physical health, more self-reported problems in their own marriages, and a higher likelihood of seeing their own marriages ending in disruption. Kids need stability. You remember adolescence. It was crazy, wasn't it? We hated our parents because they gave us rules and they gave us boundaries and they gave us security and stability. Kids need this. And when mom and dad fracture the family, that's what this does. A fracturing of the family leads to deep insecurity, deep instability in kids. As an adolescent, you ask the question, okay, I'm feeling intense pain. Who is to blame for this? Someone is to blame in the mind of an adolescent and a child of divorce. Someone is to blame here. Who is wrong? Is it dad? Is he the one who's in the wrong? Do I blame him for how I feel? Is it mom? Is it me? Who do I side with? Do I side with dad or with mom? And of course, very often we see mom is trash-talking dad, dad is trash-talking mom. And so now the kid is, they refer to this as emotional incest, where the mom and the dad are trying to take their emotional needs from the child. The child is not supposed to be the spouse. They're supposed to be the child. Where am I going to live? Do I live with dad or I live with mom? Am I switching school districts? Do I have to give up my friends? You see, all this creates tremendous instability at a time that's already difficult because your brain is maturing and your hormones are pumping and everything is difficult for you. And at the same time, you're wondering, where are the boundaries? Meanwhile, and this is the coup de grace. This is the most sickening part of this. Meanwhile, 80% of people around you are saying everything you're going through is just completely normal. Nothing is wrong. To an adolescent taking this all in, what the hell? Yes, there is something wrong. Something went wrong here. Laura Hartman, in her research, she studied 53 independent studies. That's why they call this a meta-analysis. You're looking at what everyone else has done in this area. She found that the most prevalent theme in the sample was the study of the parent-adolescent relationship. Decreased scholastic achievement. Less favorable attitudes toward marriage in girls, increased disorders, decreased coping ability, decreased feelings of well-being, decreased quality of father and son relationship, decreased quality of mother and daughter relationship, increased adolescent anxiety, decreased academic achievement, and it showed no general benefits for the adolescents. Boy, my heart resonated with that story that Ryan shared about that couple who said, we're doing this for you. We're doing this divorce for you. No, you are not. You're not doing this for the kids. Showed no general benefits for the adolescents. Again, I would be remiss if I don't keep laboring this point. We're not speaking in cases of abuse where people are unsafe. We may have a category for that. I just don't want anyone walking out of here saying the opposite. But we're saying here, marriage is... This is precious. This is valuable before God, and we ought to treat it the same way. Let's compare divorced and married with regard to kids. Poor relationship with the mother, divorced, have a twice the chance of having a poor relationship with mom. Behavioral problems in adolescence. 2.5 to 3.5 times in divorced families rather than in intact families. This is from Mavis Hetherington. She's one of those who says and researches and argues that basically divorce, children of divorce, they go through a difficult time and then they snap out of it. Not true. This is her research. This is something that's going to hurt. This is going to be a pain. We're seeing it right. This is her study right here. What about sexual debuts, having your first sexual experience between ages 12 and 15? 2 to 2.5 times higher in the divorced family. Teenage pregnancy, 7 times higher, 35% in divorced homes. Children of divorce will themselves be divorced, 2 times higher in divorced homes. Academic performance, 2.5 times higher that the child will drop out of high school. That is something very measurable, that you either graduated or you didn't. And we're seeing here, we're seeing a theme here, 31% drop out of high school. And then there is the Wallerstein study, Judith Wallerstein, her article that landed like a bomb back in 2004, where she had what's called a longitudinal study. A longitudinal study is better qualitatively. What I was just sharing were quantitative studies. We're looking at a big quantity of people, you know, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of children of divorce or spouses and their ability to remarry and have successful relationships. Wallerstein had more of a qualitative study where she tracked for 25 years the same 131 children of divorce. She compared them to a case study of 44 children who were in the same ethnicity, socioeconomic class, parents had the same education, parents had been married for an average age or around 10 years or so before the divorce. So pretty much apples and apples. And these children whom she picked had never been referred to counseling for emotional problems. Originally, I had about 25 slides to read to you. I won't do that to you. I'm going to give you one. These children of divorce almost universally said that they had unhappy childhoods. They repeatedly said that the day that their childhood ended was the day that their parents got divorced. There were higher levels of promiscuity. There was 3 times less support for college. These children had 50% less higher education than their peers. They had 50% less higher education than their parents. Now, why would that be? Because you're splitting apart the assets. You're fighting. This becomes very litigious where you're arguing, you're fighting, and now we're trying to move the money out into buying a new home. And parents don't have the money to take care of the kids. They don't have the emotional energy left over. 10% of the 131 would consider talking to dad about a personal problem. Most feared marriage and parenting. Oh, the descriptions here were heart-wrenching. Saying that, you know, even when they were in a happy marriage, they felt like at any moment the shoe could drop and it could explode. Men, 4 times less likely to get into cohabitation or marriage. They were more likely to be lonely. Women, in what she calls a counterphobic way against your phobia, launched into relationship after relationship after relationship, all the while fearing getting married, becoming a parent. And she found from her study they were 4 times more likely to divorce than the control group. Her conclusion? This 25-year study points to divorce not as an acute stress from which the child recovers, but is a life-transforming experience for the child. Let's bring it together. Friends, it's painful in my heart to talk about this. I wish I didn't have to talk about this. However, it's even more painful to ignore. This is the sin in the evangelical American church that no one talks about, no one confronts, no one deals with. And we see the wreckage. We see the pain. I know if you're sitting here and you've been through a divorce, you've been through you know, being a child of divorce, you know what I'm talking about here. None of this is news to you. You lived it. This is heart-wrenching and painful. Join us in helping other people develop a quality marriage and avoid the pain of divorce. If you're in this situation where you've been affected in this way, you have two options. One is to double down and say, no, I think that was right. Look, that was in the past. All right? Right or wrong. That was in the past. You're under grace. Paul says, forgetting what lies behind, reaching forward to what lies ahead. Let that go. Okay? You're forgiven. You're accepted. As the Father said to Jesus when he came up out of the water of baptism, behold, my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. You are in the beloved. You are accepted. You are dearly loved. God is well pleased with you. The other option is to join in helping our people develop healthy marriages, enjoying their marriages, looking to their spouses as their best friend. Join us in this. If you've experienced divorce, there is solid reason for hope. None of these statistics I just shared had the power of God involved in them at all. This would be like David going out to fight Goliath without God empowering him. Oh, I'm sure those stones would have done a whole lot, right? David versus Goliath. Unless you have God on your side, of course you're going to lose against Goliath. Of course that's going to happen. Well, this is the onslaught of the statistics we just faced. The good news here is that we are not alone. God is with us. He says, I will never abandon you. I will never forsake you. His plan is good, pleasing, and perfect. He is there to finish what he began. He loves you. He loves your kids. He loves your families. And he is behind you. Case in point, Timothy. Timothy's father was a Greek. He wasn't in the picture. He was a mama's boy. He was raised by his mom and his grandmother. He turned out pretty well. Why is it that Paul is always referring to Timothy as his son and referring to himself as Timothy's father? He knew Timothy didn't have a dad. Paul played that role in the body of Christ, in Christian community, with all of the tremendous assets that we have. We are in such a fortunate, merciful place. Thank you, God. Well, finally, if you're feeling any kind of despair, let me leave you with one couple. I don't know if you know them or not, but they were on the verge of despair. I'd like you to check out their story.
So this past April, Bev and I celebrated 44 years of marriage, and it was just an occasion once again to reflect on what a miracle our marriage is, what a gift of God's mercy. So I think the first year of marriage actually was pretty good. I think that, you know, we were both kind of through engagement, you know, on our game, realizing we've got to be, we really want to be initiating toward each other, talking through conflicts as they come up, giving each other help as well as room to work through our own fallenness, even as we adjust in marriage. I think things went south beginning year two as she was working through the stuff related to her abuse. I mean, I often was the butt end of it. In those days, the church grew in the first few years of our marriage from about 50 people to 1,000 people. So I was pretty much exhausted most of the time those next 4 years. So I remember I had one night a week to be home, and I would fall asleep sometimes at the dinner table on that one night. So I'm sure that communicated a message that was not good at all to Bev. So
about 5 years in, we both talk not in an angry, fighting way, but is there hope for this marriage? And, you know, can we really make this work? And the only problem I had to solve was how could I divorce him without him losing his job as a pastor? Because I didn't want him to have to, you know, ruin his life calling because I couldn't get it together to be married. But when things really came to a head, like Gary was saying, and people were talking to us, I'll never forget my friend Holly coming to me and apologizing for giving up trying to confront me and rebuke me. She could have said, you know, it was your fault that I gave up, because it was my fault. I wasn't listening to anyone. But she came knowing the shape we were in, and she modeled for me, seeing her part, and she apologized for not confronting me sooner. And that really began to soften my heart to see that, oh, I can confess my sin, and I can begin to own my part. I think God spoke to each one of us, and God said, where are you going to find the kind of love you're really looking for, except in this marriage and in this church? And there was a profound repentance.
It was fascinating, because, you know, you would think that at a point like that, we would be mainly focused on what the other person was going to apologize to us about. But we were both so focused, and again, it was responding to God's influence. We were both so focused on how we had contributed to our problems that we were literally almost tripping over each other to apologize. I remember several conversations just like, you know, I would say, I'm so sorry for the way that I have withdrawn from you. And she'd be like, yeah, but what I'm really going to communicate to you is, you know, and so it was amazing. I would say to people who are fighting for their marriage, fighting in their marriage, wondering, is it all worth it? A couple of things. One is that it is worth it. And, I mean, I can't quantify what my life would have been if our marriage has ended, but it's so clear to me that, you know, the richness of my life, moving outward from our marriage, there's no way that I could calculate what that other course would have been. And I would say, go to God. I mean, God met us during that time. He met us at the critical point. And it's one thing to have that in your theology, that God supports our marriage. And it's another to go to Him personally in the crunch time and go to Him in humility, saying, open my eyes to see the things that you want to change in my life. Because he is a very present help in exactly those things. Because he's more committed to our marriage than we are. I mean, there's no way ours would have survived if he hadn't been more committed to it than we were.
Yeah.
And, you know, now we have a little bit more time in our schedules, and we're around each other quite a bit more than we used to be. And, you know, those besetting sins, those idiosyncrasies, as fallen people, they're still there, but, you know, just the realization that, you know, we can continue to become more and more of a team, more and more a one. It's a wonderful thing.
I just think about them as a young couple back in the 1800s or whenever it was. They didn't know, you know, what would become of their lives. They wouldn't know the people that they would impact. Chuckled at Bev talking about Gary's calling, her calling as well, influencing hundreds, thousands of people. When I sit down to pray, I hear Gary in my head, modeling prayer for me. When I think about my wife and kids, I think of Bev's counseling to us when we were going through difficulty. So very thankful that they stuck it out. They didn't know. They didn't know the impact that was going to have. And we don't either. But I want to be able to wait to see what kind of impact it's going to be. I'm willing to wait on that.